aesthetic rationalism, which is something that hasn't really been talked about very much. There's a extensive literature on the topic of, by the way, this. How about a? So there's a kind of extensive literature on the topic of moral rationalism in metaphysics. And that topic concerns the issue of whether moral requirements generate reasons to act independently of the agent's other reasons and desires. But surprisingly, there's just really not that much on whether aesthetic rationalism is true. And you might think, well, there might be an easy explanation for why people don't ask that question very much. Perhaps there aren't any aesthetic requirements. So moral rationalism is a question about moral requirements. Do they generate reasons to act independently of agents' desires and so on? If there are no aesthetic requirements, then that would be a very easy explanation for why the question doesn't arise about aesthetic rationalism. But actually, I don't think that's the mainstream view. I don't think many philosophers think that there are no aesthetic requirements. I think people, by and large, accept that there are aesthetic requirements. One of the reasons I think silence on aesthetic rationalism is surprising is that this offers a sort of avenue for philosophers to justify and argue for a claim that a lot of people hold and they've struggled to justify using the usual kind of arguments that they provide. And that's this kind of vague hunch that I'm going to call the compellingness intuition. And the idea is that I think a lot of people have this kind of vague hunch that aesthetic requirements are importantly different from moral requirements in that they're in some sense yet to be sort of precisified less compelling, or they have less hold over agents than moral requirements do. And I think people who have this intuition, compelling this intuition, have two kinds of work to do. So they need to flesh out in more detail what this intuition amounts to, because as I've stated it so far, it's pretty vague. And they need to give some argument for thinking that the claim that they've arrived at is actually true. So what I'm going to do in this paper is I'm going to look at some existing attempts to do those two things. So attempts to say exactly what the compelling misintuition amounts to and to give a reason to think it's true. And then I'm going to say that the existing arguments, the existing attempts to do these things just fail. And then I'm going to point to a new kind of apparently promising way to flesh out and justify the compelling misintuition, and that's by arguing that moral rationalism is true and aesthetic rationalism is false. I'm going to argue that ultimately this doesn't succeed in justifying the compelling misintuition. But what's interesting is that the way in which it fails is not easy to see. And so if I'm right that it fails in a sort of non-easy to spot way, then I think we've got an argument against the compelling misintuition, and we've got a strengthened argument against it, namely all the attempts so far have failed and this new attempt also fails. But we've also got a plausible diagnosis, I think, of why people have tended to hold this compelling misintuition. I want to suggest that it's because they've seen that this sort of argument is lurking in the background, they can make it, and they haven't seen that it actually doesn't work. So the structure is going to be as follows. So in the first section, I'm going to make the case for thinking that there are aesthetic requirements, because none of this can get off the ground if there aren't any. And I'm going to sort of start off by correcting what I take to be some really widespread confusions about what the proper aesthetic analogue of moral requirements would actually be. And then in section two, I'm going to consider some existing arguments for the view that moral requirements are more compelling than aesthetic ones. And then in the remainder of the paper, I'm going to talk about this argument about an asymmetry between the two with respect to rationalism and why that looks like it works and why it ultimately doesn't. Okay, so first question, then, what are aesthetic requirements? Ethicists sometimes distinguish between the normative and the evaluative, where the normative is concerned with action guidance, like you ought not to steal, you ought to keep promises, you're permitted to favour your friend over a stranger. These are all normative claims about what one can or should do. And then the evaluative, which is concerned with sort of categorising things as having or lacking certain values, so helping people is good, stealing is bad, and so on. And obviously people tend to think that the evaluative and the normative are systematically related to each other. Okay, but interestingly, this distinction between the normative and the evaluative isn't really made that frequently in aesthetics. And I think there's some kind of unclarity about how to apply it in aesthetics. And I'm going to argue that much of the existing discussion about how we think about normative claims in the aesthetic context is just guilty of confusion. So it's quite a small body of literature where people kind of compare moral and aesthetic normativity explicitly. And I think in that literature, there's kind of two assumptions that you often see being made concerning the sort of points of comparison between the moral case and the aesthetic case. So one assumption is that whilst moral normativity concerns what you ought morally to do, aesthetic normativity has to concern what you ought to judge aesthetically good or bad. And now another similar, but at least potentially distinct assumption is that aesthetic normativity can't concern what we ought to do, as moral normativity does, but it must be normativity concerning appreciation. And you might think that these two come apart, so normativity concerning what you should judge aesthetically good or bad, and normativity concerning what you should aesthetically appreciate. Maybe they amount to the same thing, depending on your view about aesthetic value. Maybe they end up being different. I mean, appreciation, that sort of seems to lack some kind of epistemic flavour that the sort of judging idea has. But I want to say that both assumptions, and if they turn out to be two distinct assumptions, both those assumptions are misleading. I think there's several reasons why they're misleading. So first, I think it's not clear that we should classify normativity governing aesthetic judgments as aesthetic normativity at all. So normativity governing judging and belief is standardly classified as epistemic normativity, and that's so whatever the subject matter of the beliefs and judgments. So the fact that the subject matter here is aesthetic shouldn't be enough to make this aesthetic normativity. Second of all, it's hard to make the case that this diagram is supposed to illustrate the sort of assumptions that I've been making. So people have tended to think that when you're talking about directives or normativity, as I'm calling it, you get these kind of cases in the moral, but in the aesthetic, it's like what you ought to appreciate and what you ought to judge. And this is what I'm saying is a bit misleading. So I've said that these look like, or at least the sort of judging, if you were to judge Common Sense to be a good font, that looks like a kind of epistemic normativity requirement if it's not a good font. But second, I think, it's hard to make the case that normativity governing judging or normativity governing affective responses lacks any application in the moral case. So if we ought to judge certain things to be aesthetically good or bad, then it's not clear why it wouldn't be the case that we ought to judge certain things to be morally good or bad. And as for normativity governing affective responses, the extent that it's plausible to suppose that certain affective responses are called for on aesthetic grounds, it seems equally plausible to think that certain affective responses are called for on moral grounds. So if it makes sense to say that one ought aesthetically to appreciate the beauty of the Garamond font and disapprove of Comic Sans, then presumably it also makes sense to say that one ought to morally appreciate the moral goodness of helping people and disapprove of setting fire to cats, for example. It looks like you've got sort of normativity governing sort of judging and appreciating in the moral case as well as in the aesthetic case. So this doesn't look like it's distinctive of the aesthetic case. And the third reason I think it's misleading to fill in the diagram this way is that both assumptions, the one about judging and the one about appreciation, hold that aesthetic normativity differs from moral normativity, not in concerning doings, but only concerning responses to states of affairs. So both assumptions seem to deny that aesthetic normativity has anything to do with distinctively aesthetic agency. So it's as responders to aesthetic situations rather than as actors in them or authors of them that the norms governing appreciation and judgment apply to us. But it's hard to see the motivation for such an assumption. After all, I think we do talk as though there are things that people ought aesthetically to do. So, for example, I kind of got these from pamphlets about what sorts of norms that architects should observe when they're applying to for planning permission to build something. So this is a statement from the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment. It says that a building should only stand out from the background of buildings if it contributes positively to views and vistas of the landmark. That looks like an example of someone saying what someone ought aesthetically to do. Looks like they're saying that you ought to design buildings that do this, you ought to avoid designing buildings that do that. So that looks like a case of aesthetic requirements that aren't about judging or appreciating, but actually about doing. They also recommend that architects designing new buildings should respond to local building forms and patterns of development in their designs. They should only be at the appropriate scale. And they say the common practice of inflating traditional domestic forms to larger scales is generally to be avoided. So those all look like examples of statements of aesthetic requirements that aren't to do with judging or appreciating. Here's an editorial in the Japan Times that was after the Zaha Hadid design had been released for the 2020 Olympic Games. Someone wrote this editorial. A lot of people, I think, don't like the design. They wanted it to be revised. And so someone argued in this editorial, the stadium supporters just don't have the right to leave the nation with a legacy that would be a blight on Japan's first officially designated scenic area. And they also say the design should be reviewed and downsized in a manner that addresses financial safety, but also aesthetic concerns. And here's one more example. This is something that happened earlier this year. So Oxford University had built these student accommodation buildings called Castle Mill. And there was a big sort of debate in public about whether this was whether the buildings were appropriate for the location. So there was an argument that the university ought to remove the top floor of these buildings because they were tall enough that they were. It was argued that they were kind of spoiling an area of natural beauty, and that you know they were making views that used to be beautiful not available to people. And there was a, you know, the argument seemed to be an aesthetic argument for saying that they really ought to do something to these buildings and then make them shorter. And the ought seemed to be an aesthetic ought. Okay, so someone might object here. Okay, so I've given some cases that look like aesthetic requirements, and they look like aesthetic requirements of things that people ought to do, not just things that people ought to judge or appreciate. But you might object, well, aren't these just cases where it's morally required to take aesthetic considerations into account, rather than cases of distinctively aesthetic requirements? But I think that this objection isn't decisive. So consider an analogy. There are presumably cases where what one morally ought to do and what one epistemically ought to do are the same. So you ought to base your claims on the evidence as a general epistemic principle. And perhaps sometimes this is also morally required. So it looks like you get cases of moral requirements coinciding with epistemic requirements. But it doesn't follow that there isn't also a moral requirement on you to do that thing that's required. So even if these cases I've given really are examples of moral requirements, that wouldn't show that they couldn't also be examples of aesthetic requirements. Okay. I think there's also examples where there's an aesthetic requirement that just doesn't plausibly look like it's also a moral requirement. So suppose you're doing a painting and it turns out that, suppose it's true that if you use a shade of green that's too bright in what you're doing in the left-hand corner of the painting, it would just destroy the balance of the composition and it would make it less beautiful. It seems then that it would be not implausible to say that the painter ought aesthetically to avoid doing that. And that looks like it wouldn't even be plausibly a moral requirement at all. Similarly, this is a font called the Mrs. Eves font. And a lot of people say that this is actually, you know, very nearly a beautiful font, but it's kind of marred by inconsistent spacing. So again, you know, if you think that that's true, then it looks like it would also be the case that the designers of this font really aesthetically should have really thought harder about spacing and spaced it differently. Okay, so you might disagree with the specific examples I've given, hopefully not with all of them, but I take it that the general point still holds. There do appear to be cases where there are aesthetic grounds for doing or refraining from doing something, not just aesthetic grounds for responding or refraining from responding to something, just like there are moral grounds for doing or refraining from doing something. Okay, so in the rest of this paper, my focus will be on a question that arises if we take that appearance at face value, and the question is the question of how, if at all, aesthetic requirements differ from moral ones. So at the beginning I introduced this sort of vague thought which I'm calling the compellingness asymmetry or compellingness intuition, which is this claim that moral requirements are more compelling, have more hold over us in some sense, yet to be precisified, than aesthetic ones. So now I'm going to look at two arguments that people have actually given for thinking that this is the case, and these arguments also serve to sort of precisify this compellingness intuition as well. I'm going to argue that both of them fail. So the first argument comes from Stuart Hampshire in his paper, Logic and Appreciation. it's quite telling that, you know, this paper was from the 1950s, 1960s, and it's kind of telling that these are the best examples I can find of people actually going to be trying to provide arguments for this. And I think this is partly because these comparisons aren't made that explicitly very often. But Hampshire's argument here is, so I'm just going to read this out. He claims that there's this following difference between aesthetic requirements and moral ones. Throughout any day of one's life, and from the moment of waking, one's confronted with situations that demand action. Even to omit to do something positive and to remain passive is a policy. So one can suspend judgment on theoretical questions and refuse either to affirm or deny any particular solution. But no one can refuse to take one path or another in any situation which confronts him. There must always be an answer to the question, what did you do in that situation? Even if the answer is, I ignored it and did nothing. I went to bed and to sleep. So if that's the answer, that's the solution adopted. So action in response to any moral problem is not gratuitous, it's imposed. That there should be some response is absolutely necessary. One can't pass by a situation, one must pass through it in some way or another. So Hampshire here is saying that there's something distinctive of the moral, and he then goes on to say that the aesthetic doesn't have this feature. And the feature that he's getting at here, I think, is that in the moral case, even doing nothing fails to be morally neutral. So even doing nothing in response to a situation is to do something that's morally valuable, because maybe you're doing nothing was morally negligent, right? Maybe if someone says, what did you do in that situation? And you go, oh, I ignored it, I went to bed and to sleep. You know, that maybe you're morally culpable for doing that. It doesn't get you off the hook because you ignored it. And he wants to say that in the aesthetic case, it does. It's a difference here. That if, you know, suppose you're producing a painting or something and you're umming and ahhing about whether this green is too bright and blah, blah, blah. If you then decide, right, that's enough, I'm not going to think about this anymore, I'm going to ignore it and go to bed and to sleep, it doesn't look like you're aesthetically culpable. So it looks like there's this kind of contrast between the moral and the aesthetic. Okay, so, well, I guess one question is whether whether there's any sort of, whether this is a sense in which the moral is indeed more compelling than the aesthetic. But I'm gonna assume that this would be a sense in which it was more compelling. This would be a way in which we could say, look, yeah, moral requirements do have more hold over us. We can't really escape them, right? Whereas aesthetic requirements, we can sort of get out of having to make difficult decisions just by ignoring and going to bed and to sleep. So what I'm going to argue instead is that this isn't a genuine contrast with the aesthetic. I want to argue that aesthetic normativity is actually quite similar to moral normativity in this regard. What really the question sort of at root here is, I think, are there things that you... So in the moral case, it looks like there's a distinction between doing things and letting things happen. And I think that what allows Hampshire to say this, what he says about the moral, is that not only are there things that you ought not to do, there are also things that you ought not to let happen. And that's exactly why going to bed and to sleep can fail to be morally neutral, because if you do that, you're potentially letting something happen. It's not that going to bed and to sleep is always morally bad, it's just that it's morally bad when there's something that is going to happen and that you're not intervening or stopping that thing from happening by ignoring it and going to sleep. Okay, so the question really is whether there are things that one aesthetically ought not to allow to happen, just as there are things that one aesthetically ought not to do. And I think it's actually going to be quite hard to argue that there are not things that you aesthetically ought not to allow to happen. So suppose an extremely ugly building is going to be built if you don't intervene. But if you do, you stand a reasonable chance of preventing it from happening. In this case, I think doing nothing and going to bed and to sleep would be aesthetically loaded too. And it would be plausibly a case of, as Hampshire puts it, not being able to pass by a situation but having to pass through it. Or suppose that you're one of a team of people who've been tasked with producing a kind of brochure that's going to be published. And it's going to go to the printers on Friday. But your colleague has like inexplicably chosen this like dreadful twee faux handwriting kind of font for the brochure. If you don't intervene before Friday, this is going to be how it will be printed. But here again, doing nothing and going to bed and to sleep appears not to be aesthetically neutral either. So it looks like the kind of situations that Hampshire takes to be specific to ethics can happen in aesthetic case as well. So I'm not convinced that Hampshire's really identified any genuine contrast here between the two. I'm going to move on to another argument now that people offer in support of the compellingist intuition. And this is something that Hampshire also kind of at least hints at, and something that other people have said more or less explicitly as well. And this is the argument that, okay, moral requirements are distinctive in being categorical requirements, where categorical requirements are requirements that are not hypothetical. And a requirement's hypothetical when its applicability to an agent depends on their having certain aims and goals, or their having certain reasons. So an example of a hypothetical requirement would be something like, if you say to someone, look, you ought to get the 10:15 train to Cambridge. Now, that might hold only on the supposition that the person who you're talking to actually wants to get to Cambridge by 11 a.m. Or that they have some reason that they need to be there, or they should be in Cambridge by 11 a.m. But if it turns out that the person you're talking to doesn't have any reason to be in Cambridge at 11 and doesn't have any desire to be either, then it doesn't look like they're bound by this ought anymore, this ought that they ought to get the 10:15 train to Cambridge. So that looks like a classic example of a hypothetical requirement. It depends on the agent having either certain reasons or certain desires. Categorical requirements, contrast with these, they're not supposed to be contingent on the agent having any antecedent aims or reasons. So people who think that moral requirements are categorical, they'll say, okay, something like you ought to be honest is a categorical requirement because it applies to agents, no less if it turns out that they have no interest in any of the things that honesty would allow them to achieve. So, there's a debate about whether moral requirements are categorical, but supposing someone thought that they were, could they argue that aesthetic requirements are not categorical, they're merely hypothetical, and achieve a way of fleshing out and supporting the compellingist intuition this way? Okay. Well, it's all going to depend on whether they have a good case for denying categoricality of aesthetic requirements. So could it be that whether you're aesthetically required to do something really just depends on your having certain aims or certain reasons, whilst being morally required isn't as independent of these things? Well, here's a reason to think it's not going to be a genuine contrast. It's actually quite plausible that categoricality isn't really that strong or interesting a property of requirements. So Philippa Foot argues that even kind of arbitrary requirements like club rules and rules of etiquette are categorical in the sense of applying to agents no less even if they lack certain aims and desires. So here's what Foot says about... Okay, I thought I had it on here. I'm just going to have to read it out, but it's fairly short. So here's what Foot says about club rules. So she kind of thinks a good test for whether a requirement is categorical is whether, suppose you tell someone they ought to do something or that they ought not to do something. If they can come back to you telling them that by telling you that they don't, in fact, have certain aims, if you then have to go, oh, sorry, I was mistaken, then it looks like the requirement's only categorical. Whereas if you don't have to do that, then it looks like it's that this is a good test for that it's hypothetical. Sorry, wait, other way around. So if you have to go, oh, sorry, I was mistaken, it looks like that requirement was actually a hypothetical one. If you don't do that, it looks like it's probably categorical. But here's a good reason for thinking, so with the train thing, if someone goes, hang on, but I don't want to go to Cambridge, I actually need to be in Edinburgh, and I need to be there by, 10, so 10:15 to Cambridge isn't going to be any good to me. Then it looks like the person who's just told them they ought to get the 10:15 is going to be like, oh, sorry, I was mistaken. So this looks like a good test, right? But then consider club rules, which seem to be pretty arbitrary things, right? So imagine a club where there's this rule that that members of the club shouldn't bring ladies into the smoking room. This is Philip Foot's example, okay? So the club secretary tells someone, oh, you shouldn't bring ladies into the smoking room. And if this club member goes, well, hang on, I'm actually resigning tomorrow and I don't really care anything about my reputation at the club, don't care about these stupid rules, then it doesn't look like the person who's told them that they are required not to bring ladies into the smoking room would have to go, oh, sorry, I was mistaken. Right? Because if these are the club rules, they told you these are the club rules and whether the rules are silly or not, it's neither here nor there, it's still a case that the club rules require that you don't do this thing. So it looks like, and similarly, you know, something like rules of golf, you know, that's a really bad example because I don't play golf or really know anything about the rules of golf, but imagine that there's a particular rule that you ought to hit the ball in a certain way or at a certain angle, or you know, you ought to avoid hitting it over there or something like that. Then it looks like if someone goes, yeah, but hang on, I don't even care. I just don't really value winning a golf that much. It doesn't really bother me. It doesn't look like you then get to say, that you then have to go, oh, sorry, I was mistaken. Still true that by the rules of golf, they're required to do this thing. So actually, categoricality comes fairly cheap. Moreover, it looks like aesthetic requirements get to be categorical fairly easily too. So if, say, Zaha Hadid, let's go back to this. Say this Zaha Hadid architects are required to aesthetically rethink their stadium design. It doesn't look like that requirement sort of gets cancelled if it turns out that they don't really care, right? It doesn't look like there's any aims actually that the architect firm could lack. And make it stop being the case that they're required to rethink their designs. You know, if in fact they are required to rethink their designs, it doesn't seem to be contingent on them having certain aims. Okay. Similarly, if Oxford are required to do something about these buildings, then you know it doesn't really matter what their aims are. That wouldn't change the requirement on them. Okay. So it looks like we've failed to establish any kind of asymmetry between moral and aesthetic requirements in terms of categoricality, and we saw earlier that we'd failed to find an asymmetry between them in terms of the sort of neutrality or lack thereof of doing nothing. And there aren't really that many other arguments that people offer to try and support this compellingness intuition, but I'm going to suggest a third kind of argument that I think at least initially looks quite promising. I'm then going to argue that in a non-obvious way it's unsuccessful, but I think it almost succeeds, and I think that the way it fails is actually hard enough to see that whilst it kind of fails as a vindication of the compellingness intuition, it succeeds as a kind of diagnosis of why people have had the compellingness intuition, found it plausible. And I think if we've got this diagnosis, then it's a kind of, we've got an alternative story about why people think this, and we no longer have to take it seriously as an intuition that we've got to vindicate. So what is moral rationalism? So I argued just now that there's no more reason to think that what's aesthetically required of an agent depends on that agent's desires than there is to think that what's morally required of her depends on her desires. But we also saw that in this respect, requirements of etiquette and golf and club rules and so on are no different. It's fairly standard to hold that moral requirements are more compelling in some way, though, than the requirements of etiquette. And one popular way to do this is to hold that moral rationalism is true, and that rationalism about etiquette is false. So I think the following pair of examples kind of serves to illustrate what's involved in this moral rationalist claim. So we've got these two cases, these two different agents. There's Peter, who wants to wear Bermuda shorts to a formal event, but he realizes that etiquette requires him not to. But he reasons as follows. But okay, right, so I'm doing something that goes against etiquette. But that doesn't matter. I'm fine with that. After all, it's not really a priority of mine to observe the rules of etiquette. And actually, this guy, Peter, he might even acknowledge that his preferred course of action will make him count as ill-mannered or uncouth. But just kind of counter to that, well, yeah, so be it. I don't really mind being, you know, I know it's prohibited by etiquette, but I know that that would make me ill-mannered, but I don't really mind being ill-mannered, so it doesn't bother me. Okay. Now contrast that with Jill. Okay, so Jill wants to poison a wealthy relative who she knows will leave her a lot of money, but she realizes that morality requires her not to. So she reasons as follows. Similarly to Peter, right? So okay, I'm doing something that goes against morality. No matter, I'm fine with that. Of course, it's not really a priority of mine to act morally. So Jill might acknowledge that her preferred course of action will make her count as immoral, just like Peter acknowledged that his preferred course of action would make him uncouth and ill-mannered. But she might respond, well, I'm fine with being immoral. Now, I take it that most of us will think that there's a big difference between these two kinds of reasoning. I think the standard view is that there's nothing wrong with Peter's approach, but that there's something wrong with Jill's approach. And moral rationalism offers a particular way to explain what's wrong with Jill's approach. So let's talk about Peter first. So Peter, by hypothesis, he's doing something wrong from the standpoint of etiquette. He might be entirely justified, though, in some more all-encompassing sense, in ignoring this and doing it anyway. But this is compatible with what we said before about requirements of etiquette being categorical, in the sense we discussed earlier. So Peter's desires and aims still make no difference to whether he's required by etiquette to avoid wearing flip-flops. If he wears them, he's still doing something forbidden by etiquette, whatever his desires and aims are. So in this sense, the requirements of etiquette are still categorical. But here's the important thing. It's just that if etiquette isn't important to him, he might be entirely justified in ignoring its demands and doing the thing that etiquette forbids. Etiquette will not rate him highly, but you know, from some all-encompassing point of view, he might be entirely justified. And the way that rationalists often put this is that being required by etiquette to fly doesn't entail being required, all things considered, to fly. And the reason that Peter can do this is because, all things considered, he's not actually required to fly. He's actually justified in not flying. Okay, so moral rationalists will hold that in Jill's case, something different is happening. So according to moral rationalism, being morally required to do something does entail being all things considered required to do it. This is a contrast to the etiquette case. So if this is true, then Jill can point to all sorts of factors, including how she feels about morality. She might think it's a bourgeois construct or whatever, you know, you know, what she really desires and what she doesn't. She might be like, look, hang on, it's a lot of money, right? It would be great to have that money. But none of this will make a difference to what she's all things considered required to do. The fact is that, more rationalism is true, the fact that Jill's required not to commit murder is sufficient to guarantee that she's all things considered required not to commit murder. Okay. So I'm going to just emphasize two clarificatory points before we move on. So first, I've defined moral rationalism as the claim that an agent's being morally required to do something entails being required, all things considered, to do it. I'm also sometimes going to use the word required overall to do it, and I mean that in a way that's entirely synonymous with all things considered. So overall requirements, all things considered requirements, same thing. Some people define moral rationalism slightly differently. Some people define it as the view that being morally required to do something entails being rationally required to do it. I think that most of the time, these people just mean by rational requirements, all things considered requirements. And a lot of these people actually do alternate between using the term rational and all things considered. But I'm not going to be talking about the view that moral requirements are rational requirements in any other sense of rational requirement. So, you know, for example, means end rationality, or you know, coherence among the beliefs. I'm not going to be talking about the view that if you do something that is morally prohibited, then you're somehow being incoherent or anything like that. That's not the view I'm considering. So to avoid confusion with that view, I'm just going to formulate moral rationalism in terms of all things considered, such overall requirements, not using the word rational requirements. And you might wonder, okay, why call it moral rationalism? And I think that's sort of a question that's not really mine to answer. So I think I kind of wonder why people who have this debate call it moral rationalism in the first place. But the fact is that that is the name that they've given to it. And in order to make it clear that I'm in that same debate, I'm going to use the same word that they use. After all, I think it's a proper name rather than a description. Okay, so another clarification point. Some philosophers, more of an aside really, some philosophers think that there are no such thing as all things considered requirements. So a corollary of that view would be that moral rationalism would have to be, and also aesthetic rationalism and everything, would have to be false. So clearly no one who holds that view will be persuaded that moral and aesthetic requirements differ with respect to rationalism, because they won't be able to use this kind of argument to vindicate the current situation. Okay, so with that said, I'm going to move on to how exactly this does bear on the compellingness intuition. Okay, so we saw in section two that two arguments for the compellingness intuition didn't work, And those sort of tried to vindicate it in terms of the sort of greater escapability of aesthetic requirements than moral ones. This is a different way to do it, so it's not saying that they're more escapable than moral. It's not saying that aesthetic requirements are more escapable than moral requirements, it's saying that in some sense they bear on what you overall ought to do. Moral requirements bear in a stronger way on what you overall ought to do. Okay. I'm going to consider sort of one of the main arguments that people give for moral rationalism and suggest that it's not going to do for us the work that we want to do, and then I'm going to suggest an argument that does. So a lot of arguments for moral rationalism sort of proceed by identifying some kind of third, I want to call them like third factor arguments, because they sort of identify some sort of third factor between moral requirements and overall requirements, and they try and get the two to link up via this third factor. So blameworthiness is a really popular choice of third factor. So people say things like, going against moral requirements makes you blameworthy, but you can't be blameworthy for doing something that you're overall justified in doing. So you've got to be overall unjustified in going against moral requirements. And that's, of course, equivalent to saying that you're overall required to adhere to moral requirements. Now, I think that it's going to be hard to get an argument for the asymmetry of compellingness between moral and aesthetic requirements using this argument, partly because I think, now you might think it's sort of easy, because like blameworthiness is sort of like a very moral sort of notion. You might think it's an exclusively moral notion, and then it looks like you just don't have this third factor in the aesthetic case. But I think that's going to be a bit too quick, because presumably the real question to ask is, if blameworthiness really is an exclusively moral notion, the real question is whether there's an analogue of blameworthiness in the aesthetic case. Maybe blameworthiness is just the word for this notion when used in the moral case, and we've got an equivalent notion in the aesthetic case. So I think it's actually going to be quite hard to establish that this argument would establish moral rationalism and that there's no kind of counterpart in the aesthetic case. Okay, this is partly to sort of motivate thinking that the argument I'm about to give you is like the best chance that we've got of motivating moral rationalism in a way that's going to help vindicate the compellingness intuition. What it actually is there's sort of one factor, one feature of moral requirements that seems to be a point of contrast with aesthetic requirements. And that feature seems to both help moral requirements to avoid or help the moral case to avoid an objection to aesthetic rationalism, and also to generate an argument for moral rationalism. So if it's true that there really is this difference, then I think there's going to be a good argument for moral rationalism being true, and there's going to be a good argument for aesthetic rationalism being false. So I'm going to start with the argument against aesthetic rationalism, because it's, I think, a good way of pointing to the sort of point of contrast that is doing the work here. So this is the argument against aesthetic rationalism. So take some phi, such that you're aesthetically required to phi, it can be anything, but just imagine that it's something you're aesthetically required to do. Now imagine a scenario where you can't phi without risking your life. Now it's surely false that you're overall required to phi. And so aesthetic rationalism would be false, because you've got this phi that you're aesthetically required to do, you're not overall required to do it, so you've got an aesthetic requirement that isn't an overall requirement. Let me give you an example that might make this sound plausible. So suppose Eleanor is a stonemason, and she's aesthetically required to make some changes to these carvings that she's been working on the fourth floor windows of this new building. And so perhaps she's been working on these carvings, and she's just come down from there, and she can see now that she's back down on the ground that actually she hasn't, that they're not quite how they should be. So perhaps they're looking a bit clunky, a bit unbalanced, a bit inelegant, and she really kind of, it looks like she's aesthetically required to, she knows she can change it and make them look better. It looks like she's aesthetically required to go back up there and make the changes. Now imagine that actually, now that she's down on the ground and realizing this, there's an important sort of part of the safety equipment that's now been packed away and sent back to the company that they've been hired from. And now imagine that Eleanor's employers, you know, perhaps they don't really recognize the aesthetic case for making the changes. they're not really willing to pay money to rehire the equipment. So the only way that Eleanor could make the aesthetically required changes is to go back up without this extra bit of kit. And doing so would be dangerous. She'd be taking a risk, and, you know, potentially risking falling down from quite high up. So this looks like enough to maybe make you think she's not overall required to do that. She might be aesthetically required, but she's not overall required. And so this looks like a point against aesthetic rationalism. Okay, now imagine a sort of milder case, and I think this case can also be made to work. So take some phi that you're aesthetically required to phi. Now imagine a scenario where you can't phi without risking missing out on an opportunity that's important to you. Looks like even then you might fail to be overall required to phi. And if so, aesthetic rationalism, again, it's a reason to think aesthetic rationalism is false. So suppose Mark is aesthetically required to change the font in a document that he's submitting for a funding application. But doing so would take too long because, you know, he's got to change all the indentations are going to be messed up and blah, blah. So, and he's actually at risk of missing the deadline for the funding application if he does this. And if he missed the deadline, he's just definitely not going to be in the running anymore. So it looks like even if he had been aesthetically required to change the font, it looks like he's not overall required. And again, this looks like a reason to think that not all aesthetic requirements are overall requirements. Okay. Here's where there might be an asymmetry with the moral case. So now look at, I've called them demanding an assignment one prime and two prime, so these are just like analogues of those two arguments but run in the moral case. So take some phi, such that you're morally required to phi, and now imagine a scenario where you can't phi without risking your life. Surely, so the argument will go, if it was parallel argument in the other case, parallel arguments the one we just saw, it's surely false that you're overall required to phi, so moral rationalism is false. So let's run through an example. I'm going to tell you why I think this argument looks less persuasive here than it did in the aesthetic case. So suppose that Melissa has promised to meet her PhD student for supervision, but then she is, oh no, that's argument two. Let me talk about argument one first. Okay, so suppose that Sarah is walking home late at night. She sees someone being attacked, and she stands a reasonable chance of genuinely being able to help if she tried to intervene. But if she did intervene, she would be risking, you know, she'd be putting her own life in danger. Okay. I think a lot of us would be inclined to say that demanding this argument one prime doesn't really describe a possible situation. So the fact that you can't fire without risking your life, I think a lot of us would want to say, that fact stops you from being morally required to fire in the first place. Right, so you might have been required to fire when the stakes are a bit lower, morally, you know. But the fact that the stakes are so high now removes the moral requirement. You're not morally required to fly anymore. Okay. Similarly, demanding this argument two prime, so this is a case where you're required morally to fly, but now add in the detail that you risk missing out on an important opportunity. Okay, so imagine Melissa has promised to meet her PhD student for supervision, but then randomly someone offers her £1 million to give a lecture to be at the exact time of the scheduled meeting. And suppose, you know, this is going to make a genuine difference to her life, and, you know, she's not already a millionaire or anything, so it's really going to make a difference. She won't be able to get in touch with her student to reschedule. She can't do the lecture any other time. It's now or never. I think, again, even in this weaker case, a lot of us would be inclined to say that she's no longer morally required to meet her student, that morality kind of adjusts to recognise that actually what's been, if you were to do what you were required morally to do, what you had initially been required morally to do, so here it looks like maybe the what's morally required just adjusts to take account of the fact that you'd be losing quite a lot if you were to fly, and that would be enough to stop it being the case that you're morally. Okay, if you agree with me on these, then it looks like you subscribe to a principle that I'm going to call import, but other people have called different things. It looks like this principle is true of the moral, but it doesn't look like it's true of the aesthetic. So according to import, non-moral considerations can make a difference to what one is morally required to do. Specifically, non-moral considerations can sometimes trump moral ones in an overall calculation of what you're morally required to do. Okay. it looks like these demandingness arguments suggest that import doesn't hold in the aesthetic case. It looks like you're still aesthetically required to do these things. It's just that the cost to you of doing them made it the case that you weren't overall required. Morality seems to behave a bit differently. It looks like morality has this kind of reasonableness built into it that it kind of imports these non-moral considerations. And that's why moral rationalism doesn't appear to be vulnerable to this demandingness objection. Okay, so that was the argument against aesthetic rationalism, and it looks like that doesn't have a counterpart in the moral case, at least if you accept import. Now I'm going to suggest that there is an argument directly from import to moral rationalism. So if we accept import, we can run this kind of argument. So this is Douglas Portmore, who argues for moral rationalism, and he says this: if we admit that non-moral reasons can prevent moral ones from generating moral requirements, which is exactly what import commits you to, then what besides moral rationalism could offer a plausible account of when they do so? So the idea is, like, if you accept this, then a question arises: when exactly do non-moral considerations make a difference to what you're morally required to do? And Portmore's suggesting that the best answer to that question is, well, they do this only when you're not overall required, right? So if non-moral considerations prevent you from being overall required to fire, they also prevent you from being morally required. But if that's when they intervene, right, then you've got a guarantee of moral rationalism, because you can never have a moral requirement that isn't also a rational requirement, sorry, that isn't also an overall requirement. Okay. So this looks, I think, quite compelling. What I want to argue now is that this actually only really establishes a very shallow form of moral rationalism. And it's not strong enough, the form of moral rationalism that it would establish if successful, isn't strong enough to vindicate the compellingness intuition, after all. Okay. So it looks like there's sort of two ways of arguing for moral rationalism. So one would be by arguing that the link between moral considerations and overall requirements is very strong. Let me just make a clarificatory distinction. So I've been talking about moral considerations and their bearing on what one's morally required to do. So it looks like we're making a distinction between moral considerations and moral requirements, and that you have to make that distinction in order to articulate this import point. And the thought is that if you argue for rationalism in terms of import, what you're doing is you're arguing that the link between moral considerations and moral requirements is actually quite weak, because non-moral considerations can trump them sometimes, right? And so you get to secure moral rationalism by making the link between moral considerations and moral requirements very weak. Another way to establish moral rationalism is to do something very different and argue that the link between moral considerations and overall requirements is very strong. And that, I think, would be a stronger, more interesting form of moral rationalism that would be able to vindicate the compellingness intuition. But this kind, I'm going to argue, isn't strong enough. How am I doing for time, by the way?
You have another 10 minutes.
So according to the argument from import that we've just seen from Dr. Portmore, the answer to the question of when non-moral considerations are morally relevant is that they're so just when they prevent the moral considerations generating an overall requirement. So the argument from import secures moral rationalism by saying that any time a non-moral consideration trumps a moral consideration at the overall level, it also trumps it at the moral level. And so this guarantees that moral requirements are never trumped at the overall level. But that's because instead of being trumped, they're sort of cancelled. You don't get the moral requirement at all. Okay. So in a way, the argument from import secures moral rationalism by allowing the overall to impose a kind of constraint on the moral, kind of brings moral requirements into line with overall requirements. So depending on what assumptions you start with about what agents are required or things considered to do, the argument from import is going to yield different brands of moral rationalism. So what do I mean by different brands of moral rationalism? I think the best way to explain it is in terms of the distinction between moral requirements and moral considerations again. So moral rationalism entails that moral requirements are never trumped at the overall level. But now it's the same question for moral considerations. rather than just moral requirements. So despite moral rationalism's commitment to the untrumpability of moral requirements, moral rationalism is actually entirely neutral on the question of how often moral considerations are trumped by non-moral considerations at the overall level. So moral rationalism is compatible with the answer to this question being that moral considerations are trumped at the overall level always, and it's also compatible with saying that they're trumped at the overall level never, and it's also compatible with all the answers that fall anywhere in the range between always and never. So moral rationalism is compatible with all these possibilities because moral rationalism requires that when, if ever, moral considerations do get trumped at the overall level, that trumping is replicated at the moral level, meaning that they don't generate moral requirements. We don't have a case of a moral requirement that isn't an overall requirement. So here's one extreme way for rationalism to be true. So moral considerations have a huge amount of trumping power, and to always trump non-moral considerations, both at the overall level and at the moral level. So on this view, it doesn't matter whether fighting involves risking your life. If you're morally required to fight, you're overall required to fight. Morality is exceptionally demanding, this view, in two senses. One, morality requires an awful lot of you. And two, whenever morality requires something of you, you're overall required to do it as well. Right? So that's a very, very extreme brand of moral rationalism. But that's not the kind of moral rationalism that we've got from the argument for import. We've got something that's entirely at the opposite end of the scale. So this is the view that moral, so this is the other extreme, right? Moral rationalism could also be true if moral considerations have no trumping power whatsoever at the moral level. So on this view, just as the fact that helping a stranger involves risking your life makes it the case you're not morally required to help them, and the fact that, also the fact, this is how extremely undemanding this view is, just as the, you know, this removes the requirements to help the stranger, right? The fact that Jill wants to gain the money makes it the case that she isn't morally required not to kill someone for it, right? So this would be a really extreme position. So on this view, morality is exceptionally undemanding. Morality kind of has no teeth, no purchase on the world, but it makes absolutely zero difference to what agents are actually required to do, both morally and overall. The only reason it's morally, it counts as moral rationalism, is that you never get a moral requirement that isn't an overall requirement. But that's because morality is just constrained so much. So presumably, I've given you like two really extreme positions, right? But presumably most moral rationalists don't occupy either of those extreme ends of the spectrum. They're going to be situated somewhere between them. So most people who are moral rationalists will hold that moral considerations trump non-moral considerations in some cases, like Jill's case of wanting to, you know, kill someone to gain some money, right? That looks like a case where the moral considerations are going to trump the non-moral ones. But they're also going to say that there are some cases where non-moral considerations trump moral considerations, like in the case where Sarah sees a case where she can help a stranger but only by putting her own life in danger. So what unites all these views as kinds of moral rationalism is that they accept that in all those cases where moral considerations trump non-moral ones, with respect to moral requirements, they also trump them with respect to overall requirements. But here's the important point. So since the argument from import doesn't do anything to establish that moral considerations have any trumping power, it can't guarantee that we have anything more ambitious than this very, very weak form of moral rationalism, where moral requirements just don't make any difference. Sorry, moral considerations don't make any difference to what agents are required, either morally or overall, to do. So given that the argument from import can, you know, it doesn't establish anything more ambitious than this, if the only difference between moral and aesthetic requirements is this import principle, then there's no difference between moral and aesthetic considerations in terms of their bearing on what one is overall required to do. Right, so given this, the difference in import alone is going to be insufficient to establish a difference in the bearing of moral and aesthetic considerations on overall requirements. For there to be a difference in terms of rationalism that genuinely captures the spirit of the compellingness intuition, though, I think it would have to be the case that moral considerations have greater trumping power than aesthetic ones. So I've got this diagram here, which I think, I hope it's helpful. It probably goes against some aesthetic requirements, but I think it might be useful. So I take it that what we've got, if you deny moral rationalism, so you think that moral considerations are the sole determinant of moral requirements, this is like a sort of one way, say, of denying moral rationalism. So moral considerations are the sole determinant of moral requirements in this picture, non-moral considerations can kind of be can play a part in determining whether you're overall required to do the thing that you morally require to do. And I take it that the picture of the kind of moral rationalism that we get if we use import is like all you've done is kind of move this moral requirement box, right? So here, moral considerations still affect, non-moral considerations still affect overall requirements, possibly in exactly the same way as they do here, but they kind of go through this, they kind of do it by affecting moral requirements too. Right, so it looks like all we've done by saying that import holds in the moral case is that we've just moved this moral requirement box a little bit in this direction. But I think that if we want a difference with respect to rationalism between aesthetic requirements and moral requirements, and we want a difference with respect to rationalism that is actually going to support the compellingness intuition, we need to do more than just say that there's a difference in this import principle. We also need to say something about the trumping power that that moral considerations versus aesthetic considerations have. We really want to vindicate the compellingness intuition. We want to say that in some systematic way, moral considerations have greater trumping power than aesthetic considerations. So I think there are four ways of saying this. There are four different claims, starting with the strongest. So we could hold that all moral considerations have absolute trumping power, which is the power to trump every single non-moral consideration. But that would be the very strong view that we talked about before, that the kind of extreme brand of moral rationalism, where morality is exceptionally demanding. I take it that there's lots of reasons to not think that that's true, so we're not going to get an asymmetry of the aesthetic that way. What about two? The two is a bit weaker. It doesn't say that every single moral consideration has this absolute trumping power. It just says that some of them do. Now, if it turns out that there are no aesthetic considerations that have absolute trumping power, then maybe we get an asymmetry, a meaningful asymmetry with respect to rationalism this way. But I think that two is actually a really strong claim. So I'm not convinced we are going to get an asymmetry here, because I don't think that I don't think it's true that some moral considerations have absolute trumping power. I'm going to give you two very quick arguments for why I think this isn't true. So one argument is, a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people accept a principle called ought implies can. And I take it that if you accept ought implies can, so ought implies can just means that it's not the case that you morally ought to do something if you're not actually able to do it. But I take it that the fact that someone is unable to do something is a non-moral consideration. And if ought implies can, we've got a principle that every single moral consideration could in principle be trumped by this non-moral consideration, the fact that someone can't actually do the thing. So I think if you accept ought implies can, you should deny two. But here's another reason to deny two, because I know ought implies can is a bit contentious. So I think a lot of people, even people who reject ought implies can, will say that if an agent is unaware of some relevant non-moral fact, that would be enough to remove a moral requirement as well. So non-moral ignorance, most people think, might make it the case that you're not actually morally, that you're not actually required to do the thing that otherwise you would have been required to do. So then it looks like if you think that non-moral ignorance can make this kind of difference, I think it looks like you have to say that there are no moral considerations of absolute trumping power, because you've got at least one non-moral consideration, namely that the agent is ignorant of some non-moral fact, that can't be trumped by any moral consideration. Right? So I think we should deny two as well. Okay, so what about three? Three is weaker still. So this says that, actually, is it weaker still? No, maybe not. Okay, so three, all moral considerations have the power to trump some non-moral considerations. So I'm not actually clear how one would prove that this is true in the moral case. But equally, I mean, what's the state, probably, what we'd need if we wanted to vindicate the compellingness intuition is we'd want to show that this is true in the moral case and false in the aesthetic case. I'm thinking perhaps it's plausible in the moral case, but I can't see any real reason to think that it would be less plausible in the aesthetic case than in the moral case. But I'm happy to return to that in the questions in a few minutes. And then just finally, this very weak claim that some moral considerations have the power to trump some non-moral considerations. Well, this is a very, very weak claim. This is just the minimal claim that we'd need to get away from the exceptionally undemanding picture of morality. I take it most of us will think that that's true, because most of us think that that picture of morality is not right. But equally, it's so weak. It just doesn't seem to me that it would be uncontroversial to deny that in the aesthetic... Sorry, it doesn't seem to me that it would be controversial to deny that in the aesthetic case either. No, you know what I mean. It looks like it's going to be equally true in both aesthetic and moral cases. Okay, I take it these are the only ways that we get a form of moral rationalism, moral rationalism that would, where is moral rationalism true and aesthetic false, that would be a meaningful one, and that's meaningful enough to vindicate the compelling intuition. I've kind of given some reasons to think that we can't, it's unlikely that we'll be able to hold an asymmetry in any of these ways. So I think it's looking like the compelling intuition is looking like something that we ought to reject, right? So I've kind of looked at an extra argument for it, it's turned out not to work. But also I think that this argument, the fact that this argument looked so promising at the beginning, it looks like this could be a kind of plausible diagnosis of why people have tended to think that moral requirements are more compelling. Maybe they've noticed that it has this kind of import feature and kind of thought, wow, that makes it look like it's actually quite a lot more compelling than in the moral case. So this would be a sort of good explanation for why this intuition has been so popular despite it being false. So yeah, I think I'll conclude there that we should give up the compelling intuition.